truism, isn't it? That you learn more from your failures and your successes, and biting the dust hard early is just incredibly salutary, good for your soul, good for your longevity in working in the industry, as long as you're able to write something else again afterwards. It sort of can feel unbelievable that you could spend a year or something making something and that that thing might be, from the view of the world, worthless. So it's very useful, yeah.
That was the voice of the screenwriter Jesse Armstrong, and this is me, Hattie Crissell, with another episode of In Writing. You might know Jesse as the creator of the HBO series Succession, or the co-writer with Sam Bain of the brilliant Channel 4 sitcom Peep Show, which happened to be two of my favourite shows of all time. He also co-wrote the student comedy Fresh Meat, which is very funny, with Sam Bain again. And he was a writer on The Thick of It, Armando Iannucci's political satire, for three series. He then co-wrote the 2009 film spin-off In the Loop, which was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars. And there are lots more writing projects besides, some of which you will hear about in this episode. I sat down with Jesse in early October at the office of his production company in London, although, as you'll hear, he has a separate office where he actually writes. He's done a lot of interviews about Succession over the last few years, and so I was quite keen, for his sake, but also for my listeners' sake, to talk about some things that he might not be asked about so often. He was very generous in being willing to talk about some of the projects that have not been so successful, which we, you know, might not have even heard of, and what he learned from them about screenwriting. So in this episode, you'll hear his thoughts on a couple of early projects that he did with Sam Bain, plus Downhill, which was the adaptation he made in 2020 of Ruben Östlund's Force Majeure, starring Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Like many writers, Jesse likes to go offline, which we'll talk about, although I think he takes it further than most. He describes the early days of his collaboration with Sam and reflects on some comedy writers who have introduced him to very different processes, with Armando Iannucci and Chris Morris at opposite extremes, I would say. I really enjoyed listening to him talk about working on Four Lions, which was the 2010 dark comedy about four British men planning a terror attack. It won Chris Morris a BAFTA for Outstanding Debut by a British Writer and Director. Jesse is so interesting on tone as well, and how important it is to nail the tone of a writing project, and how you know when you've done it, which I think is great to hear from him because, of course, Succession and Peep Show both have such distinctive tones. I love talking to Jesse. You can hear, maybe more in this episode than other episodes, that I'm thinking of questions as we go along, because I have this feeling with him that you can delve quite deeply into thinking about small but important elements of writing, and that he enjoys as well some of that figuring things out through discussion. I think this is one of the best episodes in terms of exploring the art of storytelling. Before we start, I want to thank Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency, who have sponsored this season of In Writing. If you have ambitions to write your own TV drama series, join Curtis Brown Creative's 6-week online writing TV drama course to learn the essentials of screenwriting with video lessons and tasks from screenwriter and showrunner Colin Teven. They have provided an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners, so use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of writing TV drama or any other 6-week online course. Or you can apply to their advanced 3-month writing TV drama course in London, with lively masterclasses, workshops and one-to-one tutorials featuring advice from top TV professionals and Curtis Brown TV agents. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. But now, over to Jesse. So normally when I make this podcast, I go to the writers, whatever the room is where they write.
Yeah, we should have done it in my office in Brixton. There's a lot of train noise, but yeah, well, next I'll keep some scintillating stuff in the locker and we can do the next one in my office in Brixton.
Okay. Well, let's just imagine for a moment that we are there.
Okay.
Would you describe it for people at home? What would we be able to see around us?
Hmm. It's, yeah, I, In my dreams, it's a large, white, featureless room, like in John Lennon's Imagine videos. But it's got more and more shit in it as life goes on, and you know. So in my ideal world, it has nothing apart from me and a laptop and some sort of a magazine to read during lunch. But yeah, there's more and more stuff in there. But it's still quite empty. It has a record player. I don't know the Wi-Fi. And yeah, that's the main thing about it for me, is that it's somewhat disconnected from life. It has some research books in it, but not tons and tons of other books. And it doesn't have Wi-Fi. I try not to take my phone to work. If on the whole, I can manage that, but sometimes there's a necessity to be contactable. And there's quite a lot of train noise, but I don't mind that.
That's interesting that you don't take your phone to work and you're not online at all.
Ideally, yeah. If I'm coming to a meeting or there's something, or I'm trying to jump on a line bike to get somewhere, and then you have to have it, which I hate because it changes the texture of the day. For me, the leaving the house and leaving my phone behind is, and walking to work, I find just a really good part of the day.
Do you think it's important to your ability to write?
Yes.
Why?
There's some theoretical things which are like, when you have your phone with you, right, your every relationship of any nature you've had in your whole life is like a sort of virus multiplying in your pocket, right? Anybody from any point in your life could be in touch with you, potentially. Certainly, you know, the argument you had last night from somebody at five-a-side football could pop up and blow an hour as you sort of mull over it. So being disconnected from the possibility of all those contacts, I think, is just very healthy. And then on a practical level, you know, the phone has a hotspot. So on my laptop, I'm then able to check how the polls are in America, which suddenly feels really pressing, or also how your football team are doing, and just all the internet stuff. So being released from that is, I find, you know, really useful.
Do you find that you have... I remember hearing Zadie Smith saying that she does the same thing as you, essentially, but there come moments where you have to Google something, or you wish that you could Google something, and so she just makes a list and does all of the Googling in a sort of 10-minute block at the end of the day, rather than constantly. Are you doing something similar?
I do, and guess what? You know, you end up... You get to the end of the day, and the things which felt absolutely crucial, and you felt sort of, yeah, slightly like you were crack addict scrabbling around for the last rock that felt really necessary to fire up, most of them have gone away by the end of the day. So there are some things that are useful, especially depending on the project, but yeah, the thing that feels so crucial and useful is usually not the key. You know, hopefully you've done, even with things which require a bunch of research, I like to try and do it all and somewhat forget it.
Are there any important items in that room, or things that are in your eye line, or things that you're using?
What's important to me? Nothing. Yeah, just the laptop, and I have two screens. I think it's nice to have plenty of room for different... I like having a bunch of different documents open, plans for things, and then the actual writing itself. But apart from that, coffee machine... Yeah, nothing else is important. And ideally, a pretty clear desk, not tons of stuff around.
You don't have any sort of sentimental things to keep you going?
No, that doesn't work like that for me.
Do you have a lot of coffee?
Yeah, probably just a bit too much. That's the right amount, isn't it? Just a bit too much. That, you know, there's a comic I like called Too Much Coffee Man. There's a panel in it where he said that first cup made me feel great. No doubt the second one's going to make me feel even better. And yeah, it's a drug, and then you have a bit too much and you have to come down for a while.
Are you writing anything at the moment?
Yes.
Can you tell me anything about it? Not really.
What can I say that won't feel... Yeah, I'm trying to write a novel, and I don't know if it'll come good. I hope it will. And I'm trying to write a screenplay, a movie, and I don't know if it'll come good. But they're both pretty... It'll be somewhat disappointing if I don't finish both of them.
I feel like screenwriters are quite well trained in the mindset of things may come good and they may not come good, and that's not a reason not to do them. I think perhaps because of the nature of TV and film that things fall through, or, you know, they,
are you searching for the phrase throw a lot of shit at the wall?
I wasn't, but that is exactly the right phrase. I think it's quite a good way to be as a writer, because you don't hopefully get too hung up on thinking, well, if this isn't going to go anywhere, then I don't want to spend time working on it.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, there are two sort of monsters. The one monster of investing too much, especially as a screenwriter, and being crushed when it doesn't happen. And there's the other one, which is falling prey to the feeling that nothing might ever happen, so I'm not going to invest in it to the utmost. And so you've got to live, you know, try and sail down the middle of, like, this is definitely going to happen. I want it to be the best version of this thing that's ever been written, and yet knowing that it might not.
I always think it's a bit like dating, actually, that, like, you have to show up, braced for the fact that things might not work out, but also ready to give it your best effort. Or, like, interviews are probably a similar thing.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, I don't have a good classical education, so I was trying to think of the Homeric, I think, is it the Scylla and the Charybdis? I don't know how them. Yeah, that's
you could have said anything and I would have thought it sounded right, so we'll try again and just make something up.
I know how to look on the page, but I don't know how to say them. But yeah, I think dating might be even better. I mean, that's a bigger deal than getting sucked down a whirlpool, isn't it? You might be getting into a relationship that will last your whole life, or it might be just this 20 minutes.
Your heart smashed to smithereens in 6 months' time. You know, many, many different outcomes anyway. What's your sort of routine when you're writing something? Do you go in every day?
I try to, yeah. And I'm right in the middle of it now, in that I'm, you know, it's quite a while now since Succession's finished. I had a bit of a downtime. I tried writing some little journalism things and did a lecture and noodled around a bit. And now I'm well into being frustrated with myself for not having completed some more pages of both the things I'm writing, but I'm going in every day.
Okay. Was that useful sort of it doesn't sound like it was particularly downtime, but do you think you needed a bit of time to refill the...
Yeah, I definitely did. It was... And it's lovely to have a bit of time for reading, doing some evening classes, just restocking it, because it gets pretty threadbare, running on fumes. You might say towards the end of running a TV show, you haven't had a lot of time to fill up with other people's thoughts. You're a bit full of yourself in the sense of too much. Like a polar explorer, you've been sort of living off your fat reserves for a while, and you're a bit skinny intellectually and emotionally.
That's good. Going backwards a bit, when do you think it was first clear to you that writing was going to be the thing you were going to pursue?
Good question. My dad became a novelist, became a crime novelist later, sort of felt like later in his life. And that was a big feature of, you know, the desire to get published. We were talking earlier about your book coming out and what a big deal it is when that book comes through. And obsession might be too strong, but it was a very strong desire in my dad's life to get published. And so that feeling permeated our household growing up. So I always had that kind of, had a feeling about writing that it was an important thing. But maybe one to be wary of, and that could lead to a lot of heartbreak too. So it had an aura, and then I met Sam at university, and the possibility of doing screenwriting, which is something I had never thought about, he made very real by coming from a family that had it in its heritage, TV and film, and so it quickly transformed from being something that was rather difficult to imagine to something that was like, oh, you could make a living writing sketches for Smack the Pony and writing episodes of Tracy Beaker. The mystique was sort of taken away from it, and the ability to actually make a living doing it kind of emerged. And I suppose the aspirations to do something really, really good grew in tandem with the with the ability to like make a career out of writing.
What was your first paid writing job?
Our first paid things were when we got an original script optioned.
What was that?
I think it was called All Day Breakfast by Humphrey Barclay and Gareth Edwards who were both at LWT at the time. And so it was an original show that had some similarities to what Peep Show that we ended up making.
I was sort of looking at your IMDb page and all the things over the years, and you've collaborated with lots of incredible, incredible writers that I could list, you know, all day, obviously, but to name a few, like Armando Iannucci and Chris Morris. And obviously, that's sort of part of the nature of how TV works, that things tend to be written by more than one person. But I wondered if that collaboration also feels important to the way you work as a writer, or what you get out of it.
Yeah, in a funny way, I don't feel it's important to the way I work. I mean, I'm writing at the moment, and I sometimes collar, you know, Sam, who I still who lives in LA, but I speak to often, or Lucy Prebble, or Tony Roach, or John Brown, or Will Tracy, these writers who I'm close to and in contact with, and talk through the idea I'm working on. But that feels useful check-in, but not completely necessary. So in a way, it's been a very, very happy part of my career, and a really important one, and I've learned a huge amount from all those people, especially Sam, who we sort of learned everything together. But the writing of a page of dialogue, of script, the actual bit where it happens, has always happened for me alone, is a solitary experience. The more sort of ammunition you come to that moment with from previous conversations, collaborations, brainstorms, chats, you know, that it's wonderful to come to the table with some stuff to work with, but that the way that stuff is generated can be unbelievably heterodox. It can be the walk to work, as it is for me often now. It can be Armando's incredibly light touch of these. It was comical when I look back how brief the meetings were that we would have as when we first worked on The Thick of It, or incredibly, sometimes endless feeling as they were for when me and Sam worked with Chris Morris on Four Lions. And then, or very regimented, like me and Sam would work on our outlines together, and then go away and write separately. And I guess the succession script, this writing room worked similarly in a sort of quite defined American fashion.
And going back to when you and Sam were first sort of teamed up and writing together, how was that working, that collaboration? Was it you would sort of sit and chat a lot, and then you'd go away and do some work and send it to each other, or?
Yeah, we learned how to work together. So, you know, when we first started, we played quite a lot of chess and had very long lunches and had a really nice time bitching about all the things that were on TV that we thought we were better than, because we were, you know, coming up and young people and had that kind of vanity and ambition of youth. Latterly, you know, when it became, when we'd learned how to do it a bit more, we would have defined periods. So we would spend 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks where we'd alternate between coming to each other's houses, sit in an office, and essentially what we're doing is what you do in any other writer's room, is breaking plot. So however you want to do that, sort of in the most general what's going to happen this season way, but then quite quickly getting down to what's going to happen beat by beat in this story. And then once we had that, had the stories broken for each episode, say of Peep Show, then we'd go away and have a period of writing separately. But we had that useful thing, which I slightly wish I had now, which is at the end of the day, maybe the end of every 48 hours, you might send each other where you were at. And that's quite a good guilt-inducing technique to increase your productivity, having a writing partner like that.
Right, somebody who's keeping an eye on whether you're actually getting anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you talked about, you said that Armando Iannucci had a sort of comically light touch on The Thick of It. What do you mean? Tell me about how that worked.
Well, just, you know, I think somebody I've occasionally people have asked about what the process was for The Thick of It. And yeah, it was just an ad hoc made up process. I was more heavily involved in the first series of three, second series of three, and a bit more in the and a bit in the specials, and latterly less so. But so it was very much finding its feet maybe as a process. But yeah, it's sometimes it would just be meeting Armando in a central London hotel lobby and him sort of scratching his nose and making scratching the outside of his nose sort of quizzically and thinking, and then saying a few relatively gnomic things but you know, within them, and because, you know, I respected him so much in his work, you were quite keen to figure out what he thought, and what he thought was pretty clear. It wasn't that you weren't getting direction, it was just that he didn't spend a lot of words or time. He gave you a sense of what he thought would work and what wouldn't work, and you were left within a huge range of possibilities to sort of try and achieve his
happiness.
Sounds
like an absolute panic attack.
I suppose it could have been. It wasn't like that, and it wasn't bad. It was just very different and very loose.
Yeah.
And I guess he was discovering his technique for making that show as we were discovering how to work with him. And then there'd be maybe more, some slightly more structured meetings with Simon and Tony. But yeah, when Armando needs to have some lunch, it becomes quite a pressing need, and the meeting must end.
Okay. And then you said that on Four Lions, you and Chris and Sam, it was hours and hours in a room.
Yeah,
talking.
I mean, it's funny to think of Armando and Chris collaborating, because they're very different creative beasts, and Chris Morris likes to talk. In some ways, although I'm proud of the work me and Sam did on that film, it felt like we could have functioned almost as well as a piece of plasterboard, as Chris talked at it and figured out the movie as he went. We then wrote, you know, a fast, hopefully useful first draft that he, you know, very heavily rewrote. But I'm being facetious about it. I think we were a useful piece of plasterboard to bounce ideas off. But
I'm sure.
But in the way that Armando didn't need to speak a lot, Chris was working at doing a different creative process in very much writing that film basically himself, and he needed to find it and argue every argument. Especially it was in some ways, I would say, a more difficult piece of work to achieve, and the ideas within it had to be completely watertight for it to sort of work conceptually and comedically. Mm-hmm. And so there were sort of a lot of arguments that needed to be had in the sort of Socratic way, not a shouting at each other way.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I rewatched it at the weekend and remembered the experience of watching it the first time around, and that it was sort of saying something that hadn't quite been said.
Yeah.
About things that were in the news a lot at the
yeah.
time. And I can imagine that you want to be really sure that you know what you want
yeah.
to be saying
yeah.
before you start
yeah.
making something like that.
Yeah. And I think Chris probably had intuitively grasped the shape and the texture and indeed the arguments that he wanted to give, but then he sort of had to test them. He's got a scientific background, and it's almost like it was laboratory then, where he had to test what scenes would do what and what shapes of story would do what. Stress test it, yeah.
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 I read there was a sort of oral history thing in The Guardian about Peep Show, and which you'll remember because you were in it. And I think Sam Bain said something about how when you were going into Peep Show, you were coming off the back of a couple of what he called heartbreaking flops, which I wrote down the names of, but I can't actually read my handwriting. Days Like These and Ed Stone Is Dead.
Yeah, it would have been good if you couldn't have read your handwriting.
Is it painful to I would be interested to hear about that. And if it's sort of... if it taught you anything about the industry that you're writing in, or about how to go about things differently.
Oh yeah, a huge, huge amount. It's a truism, isn't it, that you learn more from your failures than your successes. And biting the dust hard early is just incredibly salutary, good for your soul, good for your longevity in working in the industry, as long as you're able to write something else again afterwards. Yeah, and the heartbreaking discovery that just because you've gone to work every day, there might not be anything to show for it at the end of it that's worthwhile. It sort of can feel unbelievable that you could spend a year or something making something and that that thing might be, from the view of the world, worthless.
Oh no.
So it's very useful, yeah. And they were rather different projects. One was the adaptation of an American show.
That 70s show,
which, you know, there are examples of it working and examples of it not working. This one just didn't work.
Did you have any sense of why it hadn't, or, you know, anything that you could have done differently if you'd, or was it just a bad luck of?
Yeah, I think the successful ones, you need maybe some sort of, does Doctor Who have two hearts?
Is that a riddle, or is that... I've never seen Doctor Who.
Haven't you?
No.
Nor me. But I know what it is. I think he has two hearts.
I wasn't sure if that was a sort of aphorism or something.
I think Doctor Who has two hearts. But if he doesn't, let's for a moment to imagine he does. You need a sort of two-hearted beast, I think. You know, the original show needs to come from something sort of internal, visceral, hearty, and then you need another one of those in the transplanted country. And if you lack that, you know, they obviously had it with, you know,
The Office,
Sanford and Sons, and, you know, there's many shows that have succeeded that transplanting, but there's lots that don't. And I think if you just, and I don't think we had a successful heart transplant, there were a bunch of people who sort of thought we knew what we were doing, but I don't think there was anyone who was like, we've got to make this show. I want to make this show. But it was more of must make this show about the 70s. It was more of a gig, a product for everyone involved, or try as we might to sort of put some heart into the Frankenstein.
Do you think a good show needs somebody who feels really emotionally invested in it behind the scenes?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's essential. I mean, maybe you can make some kind of producty show that will have a life that's sort of cynically made and is a sort of, wipe clean vessel that can be shoved out into the world, but not an interesting show that people will return to or means something or says anything. I think, almost by definition, it has to have somebody who has something to say. Not that it needs to be something, you know, terribly profound. Even if it's a quote silly comedy, you need to love silly comedy and want to do the best and have the silly comedies that you love in mind and why you want to be amongst them.
And what about Ed Stone is Dead? What happened there?
Yeah, maybe it's another heart transplant problem, in that it was the idea of a producer, a nice man and a channel controller, and then the writers were sort of brought in to once again Frankenstein this somebody else's monster into life. And I don't think honestly anyone in that writing room, because it was a sort of show that was conceived and written by a team, not without an existing pilot. You know, the way that a writing room should work is somebody has created a pilot, then you get a room together and you try to take it from there. But if you try and write the pilot together, there's you know, it's very hard for it to have any consistency of tone or point of view. So we were all, it was another gig where we were just trying to kind of wing it and get away with it. Will this do it? And it won't do.
It was a good concept from what I saw on Wikipedia. I mean, it could have been.
Could have
been really good. I haven't
seen
it. It's
like one of those people who, you maybe have this, I have it. Sometimes people come up to you and say, you should do a show about this. You know, I work in a sports shop and it's really funny. And then
the delivery. You should do a show about that.
Exactly. Yeah. I can't do it.
Last time we talked, you mentioned Downhill and that it had been a bit of a tricky.
Downhill, yes.
Project.
Yeah, so Downhill was tough. I really, really admired Force Majeure, Ruben Östlund's Force Majeure, the the original movie. And yeah, I sort of had a... Normally those things are a bad idea, as I've said, remaking something. I sort of had one idea, which was maybe in place of the chilly reticence of the brilliant original, you could put some sort of... You could... Where maybe there was this, yes, Nordic quiet, you could fill it with Anglo-American chatter that was similarly...
Sort of empty.
Exactly. And that might work. And I just think maybe it didn't work. And that, you know, and maybe, you know, might have needed a writer-director who could have come through with that singularity of vision. And maybe, they were nice directors, I think, nice guys. And I had meetings with them. We were cordial and professional, but I don't know if ever we sort of melded in the way that might be necessary for a really successful creative project. Or maybe most films aren't great, most TV shows aren't great, and maybe it was just another one in that long line of things which didn't quite work because of a whole host of reasons.
Had an incredible cast as well.
I mean, yeah, both of whom are, you know, the leads, you know, especially is I admire hugely, and the, you know, worked briefly with Julia on Veep and had met her and admired her, and yeah, and there's really no one funnier than Will Ferrell, and I'd met him and admired him, and yeah, so I don't think that was the issue, but who knows.
Why do you consider it not a success? Is it because you, when you saw it, you thought, I just could have done better than that. This isn't as funny as I thought it was going to be, or...
I think, like, tone is the thing that I... the elusive thing that I chase, and I think, you know, whatever else was not... didn't work in Ed Stone and that 70s show that we remade, they didn't have a tonal completeness to them, and I think probably... whereas Force Majeure was a tour de force of tonal singularity and accuracy... That didn't come together on Downhill as it doesn't on so many projects. That would be the sort of single biggest, and you know, it's quite a problem at the heart of your project if it doesn't have a consistent tone.
So do you think that to have a good writing project, there needs to be somebody who sort of owns it, you know, like a sort of auteur, in order to have something that's really as good as it could be?
I think I do. The contradiction, obviously, is that film and TV is such an extraordinarily team... their team-created media, and so I have hesitation, because it, you know, I've had extraordinary collaborations, you know, with me and Sam, with Phil Clark, producer, and then Becky Martin, director on Peep Show, and also with Dave and Robert, who created so much of the tone with their own comedy... And Succession is just full of collaborations, but I guess it doesn't need to be a single individual, but often it can be. And in the absence of another rock solid center to your show, an individual is the best single potential way to getting a consistent tone. So yeah, there's teams, there's producer, director and writers who work together often and get consistency of tone. So it doesn't have to be one person, but it can be.
Let's talk a bit more about tone.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to think, what is the question I want to ask here about
good.
Tone?
Good, if you can find out the question to answer, I might be able to find the answer.
I mean, we all know what tone is, but it is quite a nebulous thing, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Do you, coming at it from a writing point of view, when you're working on a show, if you think maybe about Succession,
yes,
and what was kind of going through your head as you were establishing the tone, I suppose tone is something that you probably need to establish pretty early on,
yes,
in a TV context.
Yes.
And how do you know that you've got it and enough of it, you know, that it feels, that every scene feels like it's from that show. It's actually, I'm just thinking about this and thinking novelists have talked to me about this on the podcast before. That,
have they?
Well, actually, for the book, I interviewed Meg Wolitzer, and mm-hmm. she said that she spends a lot of time on the opening of her novels.
Yeah.
Because she feels that the tone in the opening of the novel becomes a sort of blueprint for the whole novel, and she has to make sure she knows what it is.
And I think it's Adie Smith in her, one of those good essays about writing, says the same thing about doing these hundreds of beginnings, and then when you've got it, it's so interesting and so crucial tone, but it's quite difficult to talk about, and it's quite difficult to describe the moment when it happens. I guess what we can say is that it can be something very small. It can be, it needs to grow, obviously, but it could can kind of grow out of a line, or almost a look, or a frequency of in a scene, a temperature in a scene. This is a description rather than a prescription of how to get somewhere, so it's not necessarily useful to a writer, but maybe it's useful when you recognise it, that you get a feeling. I think that's how I would describe it, a feeling like this is right, this is the right tone for this, and it somehow, if it is the right tone, contains within it many mansions of other rooms. And you know, the tone of Succession was actually, as some people have noted, quite various, and there's, you know, funny scenes and sad scenes, but they can all be implied in something quite small. So yeah, for some reason I want to try and turn this into a piece of advice, and maybe it isn't a piece of advice, but the only piece of advice I have is that it might be small, but if it feels right, you know, that's your petri dish that you might be able to grow a whole disgusting set of bacteria from.
Do you remember from the kind of early days of writing Succession any moments where you felt, oh, this is going to be the tone, this scene feels like a Succession scene, I want more of this feeling?
Yeah, I'd already written this, you know, sort of cousin antecedent script about the real Rupert Murdoch. There's not much, I don't think, of that screenplay in Succession, but the tonal connection is probably quite strong. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say it's partly a documentary, you know, and I think that's quite often a one way of thinking about things that I write, is it's a documentary about people who are not real. You know, that's a tone that's, I find, quite appealing. And so it can be, and it helps you maybe not put too much exposition in, because mostly, you know, an engaged audience enjoys the process of putting together the story from the pieces they're shown. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's on the tip of my tongue, but it wasn't hard. It's unlike when I've sometimes written prose, I have done the many beginnings thing and had these questions about, you know, tense, point of view, third person, first person, free indirect, more direct sort of versions of a prose voice. I didn't have any such experiments with Succession. It came pretty fast and pretty clear. And I can't really say what the keynote of that tone was, apart from maybe a certain sort of pitilessness.
How are you finding it writing a novel, having not... You've written a novel before, but a while ago. When was your first novel?
2015-ish.
Oh, not that long ago,
not that
really.
Long ago, no. What? Thank you. once a decade, rain or shine.
What's it like returning to that mode?
Well, it's great. It's great. There's lots of things you can do in a novel that you can't do in another form. In particular, talking about people's interior states. It's technically challenging. It's a lot of work, a lot of pages, a lot of words. The screenplay is quite a restricted form, you know, in terms of what you can and can't do. And a novel's much more capacious, and that's can be quite daunting when you're used to the economy of a script and the focus of just saying what the people say and giving some ideas of what the actors might do with it as well, which are the sort of the two limbs you're working with in a screenplay. But yeah, the novel is daunting from having so much that you can possibly do, so much authorial room for manoeuvre. But yeah, very enjoyable too. I like it. It's daunting, but I like it.
You also mentioned last time we spoke that one of the things that you're thinking about quite early on when you're working on an episode or a season of television is trying to decide what the end point is going to be.
Yeah.
And I thought about that a lot afterwards and thought, how do you... First of all, why is that helpful to you? And secondly, how do you avoid the temptation of then like retrofitting the rest of it so that you end up in this end point that you like the feeling of?
Well, in some ways, that is part of the job of... I mean, you can't start a sentence without knowing where you're ending it, right? And on a bigger level, you probably, the same goes for a paragraph, maybe a page, and possibly a book or a screenplay. So I think in some ways, that's what you're doing, is retrofitting. Or another way of saying retrofitting is telling a story, right? You tell the story in the way that you think is appropriate. And for me, the ending is just unbelievably important. The feeling that you end a book or a film or a TV show with. Yeah, I mean, it's crucial. I guess you can have a sitcom which doesn't have a great ending and it can still be a great sitcom. I don't think the same goes probably for a novel or a movie. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is a danger implicit in your question, which is that you get locked into a shape which makes the rest of the piece a kind of laundry chute, kind of barreling you towards this preordained ending. That's no good. You want the audience to feel the characters' choices as real choices and their freedoms as real freedoms. But as a craftsperson, the knowing the shape of the architecture of what you're doing is to me crucial. And even those people who, and there are many, who like to not have everything mapped out. I think other people have asked me about the ending of Succession, and I didn't know what the ending of it was in terms of the corporate, who's up and who's down. But I knew what the feeling would be at the end of it. I knew what I wanted to say about that world and that family. And I think the same goes for those writers. I would think certainly the successful ones who don't know where their stories are going. If you literally don't know whether it's going to end up with the end of the world or a marriage, you might be able to fit either of those into the same tone. But if you know what you want to say and you know the tonal world you're within, then you can have a sense of an ending without knowing the precise configuration of it.
You also said that every line of a screenplay has a sort of infinite possibility for what you can express with it, that it can tell you something about the character and it can tell you something about the world, and it can be funny or it can be heartbreaking and it can move along the plot. And it made me realise sort of how rigorous... Well, that's such a rigorous approach and a sort of, sort of bottomless approach to the work. And I wondered, do you find it easy to tell when you've done enough and to let go of something? Are you a perfectionist?
A bit. I like the process we have on Succession of having alternative lines so you can leave a little bit of space for maybe, especially for jokes, that maybe we can beat this, especially often a joke, you're like, I think this is the right place, this is the right shape. Sometimes you feel you've nailed it in the script, you don't want anything else there. But sometimes you're like, oh, there's a shape here of a thing, but there might be a funnier way of doing it. And so it's nice to kick that can down the line. Am I a perfectionist? Yeah, a bit. I want it to be perfect. If it can be, I know it won't be, but you've got to try.
When is enough enough?
Do I know when it's finished? I do know. I feel like I do know that because... And I find the read-through process very important for this. And we always do read-through. Everything I've ever done, we've done read-throughs apart from things I haven't been so intimately connected to.
So when you say a read through, you mean
reading the script through with
as
the,
a room, as,
in a room with the you know, the majority of the actors okay. who are going to perform it. You can do it without those actors if you can't get them, but and it still tell you things. But ideally, with the performers who are going to be in it in the key roles, and then I think I have enough experience or developed confidence to know that if the thing is working, if like the ending is right and the rhythm in particular of the episode is right, that yeah, you the clock is going to run out on the TV production schedule. So there are things, you know, they say all edits are abandoned and all writing is abandoned eventually on a show when the day comes to shoot it. I hope I know, right, this is good, this is solid, this works, this is going to be satisfying, and it says what I wanted it to say. But you can keep on working on bits of it. You can keep on making that line funnier and this bit better and this line richer and this piece of this reference to some piece of backstory more elusive and intriguing. But yeah, I'm not any time after that moment of a satisfactory shape to the episode, I'm happy. If they said, look, the schedule's changed, we need to shoot this tomorrow, I'd be heartbroken because we wouldn't have time to do all those last things, but I could live with that.
Mm. Are you ever writing right up to the wire kind
of
thing?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, ask Brian Cox, so he'll probably shout across London to you about about that. Yeah, I rewrote, especially as the showrunner, right up down to the line. You know, often there might be pages coming out the night before people were working, which is very hard on actors and particularly ones who want to prepare in a certain way to have those changes. And so I'm being glib, you know, it was tough for Brian and the other actors to accommodate those late changes sometimes. But
great, yeah, I mean, show,
yeah, thank you very much. Well, yeah, yeah.
Worth it.
Hopefully.
Is there anything you found particularly challenging as a writer?
I'm not good at songs.
That seems unnecessary. I feel like you could do a career without having to write songs.
Yeah, well, I've been around good songs. They're not usually written by me. Can't do songs. Most things were a challenge. I like the feeling of like, this is going to be tough. How are we going to fix it? It's very, very flexible format script. You know, you can all, you know, you don't need to show the scene, do it in, show the next scene, show 2 days later and see what happened. I don't really like puzzles in everyday life, and I'm not, maybe because I'm not very good at them, but I do like the puzzle of a narrative and what is the most pleasing way to tell this story to someone. So most things I can turn into a enjoyable challenge. I guess maybe with sometimes a tone can be feel so sort of imminent and exciting, and probably most writers know this, and then the thing that you eventually write feels an inadequate expression of your hopes for it. That's tough, isn't it? But you know what? I think you can sometimes ignore that feeling, because if you've got a really high ambition for your idea, even if you only get 70% of it onto the page, which often I think I would feel about even things that have been quite successful, like Succession, feel like, oh, we could have done so much more. There could have been even more in this. A lot of it is going to get transmitted to the audience. They didn't know how big your ambition was in the first place, so having the ambition is probably the most important thing. But yeah, that can be painful if you feel ambition unfulfilled.
Mm. Can you remember any pieces of advice or any moments in your work where you've had a bit of a breakthrough and thought, oh, I can do things this way? Anything that's improved your writing?
It's a trick, but to give yourself reveal the infinite possibilities, the infinite goes you have at something. So just opening a new document, you know, if you've got, I often do this, I've got a tough scene and it's a bit, difficult to bring to life, just opening another document that's completely fresh, and maybe putting the one line in that does work or that you like, or none of them, and just starting again, not in the body of the sort of terrifyingly solid document that exists there as the Bible of the script, the show, and remembering that you can put anything in there and anyone could come in or leave at any point, and it could be as short or as long as you want. And opening, you know, 6 or 7 of those documents and messing around with them, I find that's liberating.
Yeah. Anything that takes the sense of pressure off you is usually quite helpful.
Absolutely.
People do things like just moving to sit somewhere else, or, you know,
yes,
printing things off, or, you
printing
know, all
it
that
off
stuff.
And also just going for a walk, maybe talk with someone, or maybe just talk with yourself as you walk to the, you know, rhythm of your legs is really great at unlocking things. And you can so often forget it, and then you walk home and realize, why was I sitting there all day when I could have done this magical thing?
Yeah. And thinking about your writing life, what are you most proud of so far?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I think it might make me vomit to say that.
Come on, think about
what it. What I'm most proud of? Sometimes, yeah, this is, yeah, I don't know if I'm, makes me uncomfortable. Yeah, sometimes I've met writers who have said that Succession has made them feel optimistic about the opportunities available in making a TV show, like what you can do in it, and it's made them feel optimistic in a landscape which is sort of rich in TV, but maybe not as rich as it could be. And so that's I'm proud of that. I'm delighted to hear that, because it means a lot. I'm very pleased to hear it.
That's a really good answer. You did really well. Thank you. Thanks for humouring me.
Not at all.
A huge thank you to Jesse Armstrong for being a wonderful interviewee. He's been really generous in speaking to me not once but twice. This was the second time, but last year we sat down and talked for my book, In Writing, Conversations on Inspiration, Perspiration and Creative Desperation. So if you pick up my book, you'll find exclusive stuff from Jesse in there, talking about ideas and the process of getting inspired, plot structure, language and more. He was a total pleasure to speak to for the book as well. And again, I think it's because he has a real sort of curiosity and takes an almost philosophical pleasure in thinking about the work, not just doing it. In case you were wondering, as I was, what the Greek myth that Jesse was referring to was, it was of Charybdis and Scylla, both of which I'm probably mispronouncing. They were sea monsters, and the story was that sailors had to pass between the two of them and avoid being sucked into a whirlpool on either side. Also importantly, I can confirm that Doctor Who does have two hearts. Please go and watch all of Jesse's TV shows and films. I'll put a link to his IMDb page so that you can browse the back catalogue, but I even enjoyed Downhill, to be honest. His novel, published in 2016, was Love, Sex and Other Foreign Policy Goals. Also, if you want more insight into the process of writing Succession, you should go and listen to my previous episodes with Lucy Prebble and Georgia Pritchett, who were both in Jesse's writer's room on that show. So I'll link to those episodes in the show notes as well. Today is the 5-year anniversary of the day that I released the first ever episode of this podcast. It's been a wonderful project for me to be able to return to again and again over that 5 years, and I've learned so much from it. And if you've come to the podcast recently, I would really recommend delving into the back catalogue, because I've spoken to so many wonderful screenwriters, novelists, poets, journalists, comics, cartoonists and more. A reminder before we go that if you want to learn more about screenwriting, you can start today with Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. That's all from me. This is the final episode of the 6th season, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
Please do take a moment to rate and review it if you have, as that really helps it to find new listeners, or send an episode to somebody you know who might enjoy it, and I hope they do. Thank you so much for listening, and bye for now.